Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. This week's episode is one of a series of conversations on the world that awaits the Trump administration. The conversation focuses on the rise of Asia and what that means for the United States and for the wider world. Our speaker is the Honorable Kevin Rudd. He's former Prime Minister and former Foreign Minister of Australia and is now President of the Asia Society Policy Institute. He's in conversation with Ken Wilcox, co-chairman of the Advisory Board of the Asia Society of Northern California. This event was recorded before an audience in San Francisco, and the broadcast is made possible weekly by the generous support of Chevron. And now to Kevin Rudd and Ken Wilcox.
We are exceedingly pleased to host Kevin Rudd, President of the Asia Society Policy Institute. I'll provide a brief bio for Mr. Rudd, though I won't do his impressive resume justice. Mr. Rudd served as Australia's 26th Prime Minister from 2007 through 2010, and also in 2013. And as Foreign Minister from 2010 through 2012. Among his many accomplishments, he led Australia's response during the global financial crisis. He was a driving force in expanding the East Asia Summit to include both the US and Russia in 2010. He ratified the Kyoto Protocol in 2007 and legislated in 2008 for a 20% mandatory renewable energy target for Australia. Domestically, Mr. Rudd delivered Australia's formal national apology to Indigenous Australians. So we'll begin with remarks by Mr. Rudd and then move into a discussion between Mr. Rudd and myself and all of you. So let's get on with the program. Kevin?
Thank you very much, and thank you for that very kind introduction. It's good to be back here in San Francisco, beautiful west coast of the United States. It's good to be back in California. We in Australia always see ourselves as California West. It's good on this occasion to be seen to be on my way home. My wife and I now live in New York, I'm very privileged to be the president of the Asia Policy Institute, part of the Asia Society family. The other reason I'm always pleased to be here in California is you have a different perception of Asia than you find elsewhere in the United States. It's a perception which is the product of proximity. It's a perception which we share in Australia. Asia, more broadly, China, Japan, more particularly, and Southeast Asia are not foreign policy abstractions for Australians, they're day-to-day realities. I think, to some extent, that is the case here on the west coast of the United States as well. As you move further east, you then find yourself into a much more interesting competition for the public policy dialogue in terms of the Pacific and the Atlantic, Europe and Asia, and the rest. The truth of it all is, from the great country called the United States of America, the world's remaining superpower, these are not mutually exclusive equations. You are both Pacific, you are both Atlantic, you're in Asia, you're also in the Americas, and you're also in Europe. And at these times, and most particularly at these times, there is a continued need for US global leadership. What I've been asked to talk about this evening are what I see as the challenges which lie ahead for peace, stability, and prosperity, and sustainability, the big ones, staring us in the face for the year 2017. So I call the year 2017 the year of living dangerously, because there's a lot of danger out there at the moment. And I say this not to simply give a litany of things that can go wrong, could go wrong, and could well go wrong, but also to point to ways through as well. So let me give you what I would regard as my top 10. And then let's open it to a discussion and questions from you, the audience. Number one, unsurprisingly, in this year of living dangerously, is a sense of genuine global uncertainty about the future policy directions of the Trump administration across the board. This is new for the world. because so much of the assumptions about America and its political system has assumed a high degree of, let's call it, international policy continuity. And what we see now is, as proclaimed from the White House, a new age of disruption, articulated as such. As Mr. Bannon said the other day, the administration is not there to do small things, it's to do big things, and the intention is to be disruptive. Now, whereas that message is primarily addressed to the US domestic audience, let me tell you, those of us around the world look at this and we parse it, we analyze it, we deconstruct it, and our German friends probably put it into a different level of grammar and case as well. But we all look at it with intensity. And when we look at it, the sheer fact of uncertainty itself on global security, on global trade, on global climate, contributes, I think, to what we have already seen prior to the administration, which is an increase in what I describe, what is an objective measure of many of these things, the Global Uncertainty Index. As of the end of 2016, way before candidate Trump became President Trump, the 2016 index is at the highest level of uncertainty that we've seen since the beginning of this century. That affects corporate decisions on where you put your money. It affects individual decisions on whether I'm going to spend or save, invest or save, or just find a mattress and throw it underneath. It also affects the behavior of states if they think that there are no longer the certainties of the past applying to their security. That, therefore, is what I describe as challenge number one. Challenge number two is the drill down. And let me start from a not the traditional points of reference in Asia, but let me go to Russia, because in the Asia Society, we take the United Nations definition of Asia everywhere from Tokyo to Tel Aviv, and that it does include Asiatic Russia and therefore Russia itself. The future trajectory of US-Russia relations, what's it going to be? We've all observed, again, what President Trump and candidate Trump have said about the desirability of a form of normalization of that relationship. We know what the historical friction points have been, both in relation to the Ukraine, Crimea, Eastern Ukraine, also in relation to Syria, and also more broadly in terms of cyber as well. I think, having spent some time in Russia since the election, it's worth making this observation, that there is not necessarily a universal expectation in Moscow that normalization is going to be an easy road. And therefore, for those who are simply assuming that black will become white, it's going to be actually a much more complex picture of gray. There'll be limitations in terms of how far President Trump may want to go, or is allowed to go by the various other arms of the United States government. There will be expectations which may not be met by various within the Russian political establishment as to what is an acceptable outcome both on the ground in Syria and in the Ukraine. And those of you who've studied this closely will have seen the recent statements by the recently newly appointed American ambassador to the United Nations on that subject. So there is an uncertainty about whether in fact normalization with Moscow will be big, medium or little, and what reverberations that will have, including blowback from Russia itself if the expectation of normalization is not realized. Risk number three, challenge number three, US-China. You've observed this closely, as have I. The five big ones which have hit the headlines, both from candidate Trump and President Trump, are broadly in these categories. One, China does not treat the United States fairly in trade. Two, China is a currency manipulator, according to President Trump. Number three, China has not helped the United States solve North Korea. Four, China has obtained illegal possessions in the South China Sea through land reclamation. And furthermore, through Secretary Tillerson's testimony, the United States now stands prepared to prevent China resupplying its illegally reclaimed territories. And then number five, perhaps the granddaddy of them all, the series of statements from the president on the future of the One China policy as it relates to Taiwan. That's the quick summary. That is quite a big list. Each one of them is worthy of a substantive seminar in itself. But put into aggregate form, this has created a new set of uncertainties in the US-China relationship we haven't seen for a long, long time. We can come back to this in the open conversation, but I would say this. It's the first time since Kissinger and Nixon, and certainly since normalization in 79, that we've had the One China policy out there center stage as an optional negotiating chip as opposed to a fundamental precondition for the future of the US-China relationship. Challenge number four goes to a combination of two and three above. What happens with the future of the strategic triangle between Moscow and Beijing and Washington? Kissinger, Nixon, and Kissinger the grand strategist, effectively in 72, created the strategic triangle which has underpinned most of the reality of the global order since then, namely a US-China de facto strategic cooperative relationship against what was then a problematic Soviet Union for both countries. Both China, because of historical disputes along the border, and prior to that, deep ideological divisions, and with the United States, because they were still in the middle of the Cold War. And to some extent, post-91 and the collapse of the Berlin Wall and the liberation of Eastern Europe, that continued strategic assumption remained, though it drifted over time. So the open question now is, if there is a reaccommodation with Moscow, and if there is, therefore, a deep reappraisal of the future assumptions about the US-China relationship, can we see, therefore, a rearrangement of the strategic triangle, which has Russia and the United States in a new broad strategic condominium, with China, in fact, now isolated from both? That puts it in extremis, but does it lend itself to a position whereby President Putin, for example, now has a much more flexible swing position in dealing with the Chinese and the Americans, whereas at present, being frozen out by the Americans, financial sanctions included, he finds himself at present largely dependent on China and in a secondary role in relation to the Chinese? This is an open question about future strategic risk. Number five is North Korea. This is by far and above, against any objective analysis, the single largest national security challenge facing the United States in this year ahead. The reason for that is not political, it's not ideological, it's technical. There is a technical timetable which the North Koreans have been working to in acquiring a nuclear weapon which is capable of being miniaturized, put on the end of a missile, and then capable, therefore, of posing a direct threat to US allies and or United States territory itself, either in the West Pacific, the Central Pacific, or even here on the West Coast. The conclusion by those who look at these things carefully is that the North Koreans have actually got to the stage where they are very close to crossing those thresholds. Miniaturization, long-range missile capability, the Taipei-Dong 2 missile, and certainly enough fissile material or nuclear material to construct what is now described as a comfortable arsenal of 10 to 15 bombs, growing by probably 5 bombs per year. Whether we wish it away or not, it is one of those uncomfortable realities which exists. Therefore, the actual crux, I think, of the US-China relationship in the year ahead, if rationally pursued, should be about how do we prevent this North Korean challenge to the existing regional order from causing a much deeper strategic crisis. I'll chip through just by headline 6 through 10, and let's open up to discussion. 6 is, what is actually the future of the global rules-based system more broadly? The assumptions about global trade, the assumptions about global economic governance, the assumptions about global political governance through the United Nations. How will we handle it if instead of the historical assumptions about US global engagement, in fact we now have on trade an overtly protectionist US president? What will that mean for the future perceived integrity of the World Trade Organization and the rules which exist underneath it and the disputes resolution mechanisms which exist underneath the WTO? Will they be continue to be applied? Will they be ignored? And if we have the unilateral imposition of tariffs, either against Mexico or against China, and if retaliatory measures are taken and disputes resolutions are invoked or ignored, what then happens for the rest of the rules-based system? On broader global economic governance, the question which is in the mind of many is this, and as someone who is a co-founder of the G20 and was dealing in office and with colleagues around the world, including President Bush at that time, on the massive implosions which arose from global and particularly American financial markets in 2008, what now happens if the administration radically rewrites Dodd-Frank? Dodd-Frank exists because of the American policy response and the global policy response to so many of the systemic financial problems which existed in this country and in Europe and in certain other places leading up to the crisis of 07-08, of which subprime was simply one manifestation of a much broader systemic problem. Dodd-Frank was the response to that. I'm not here to comment on the virtues or otherwise of it or its implementation. But if we find a US administration which then rolls back Dodd-Frank, rolls back regimes on capital adequacy of financial institutions, rolls back internationally agreed norms on too big to fail, as well as the other reform agenda which has come out of it globally, then I think the unravelling of the G20 begins to loom as well, given that was its primary rationale in the first place. And then the United Nations itself. We've seen what President Trump and candidate Trump have said about early decisions by the UN Security Council. It is an uncertain question whether this, together with the Bretton Woods architecture designed by the United States in 44 and 45, can easily survive if its principal proponent in the first place, named the United States of America, then has a qualified, equivocal, or negative level of support for the continuation of that architecture. Four final points, and I will do these in serious dot point. Future of Europe, NATO, European Union. If we're putting together our list of global risk factors for the year ahead, this looms big. You've followed the French elections and the preparation for the primaries, the challenges now of candidate Fillon for the Republican Party. What will happen? Will the impossible occur? Will Front National actually win? What about the impact that then has on the future of the European Union? If a mainstream party does not win in both France and Germany, I think it's fair to say the European project may well be over. We therefore need to see either of those mainstream parties win in both those capitals in elections due in 2017. And as for NATO, you would have seen Prime Minister May hard at work in her visit to Washington the other day to ensure that the views that she derived from her meeting with President Trump on the centrality of NATO for the future interests of the United States were publicly expressed both on behalf of herself and President Trump, in case he forgot to say it himself. These are deep questions in terms of Europe's future strategic stability and strategic course. Challenge number eight is if there is a perceived lack of certainty in the countries of Asia, by which I mean not China, but Korea, Japan, Southeast Asia, India, countries such as my own, about the future determination of the United States to maintain a forward strategic presence in the region, what will regional states then do in terms of the adjustment of their own policies towards the future? This would change so many of the fundamentals that have underpinned strategic assumptions for those countries for the last three quarters of a century, or at least since the end of the Vietnam War. Second last one, again in the broad remit of Asia, but I need to mention it, is it's always easy for those of us who focus on Asia, whether it's East Asia or South Asia, to ignore the Middle East. It falls within our definition. But any decision to recognize Jerusalem as the capital and to move the United States embassy to Jerusalem would produce, in my view, a high risk of a third intifada within Israel itself and untold levels of instability across the wider region. Finally, I would simply say this: there is the great question, the enveloping question of climate change. Climate change, difficult progress. I'm a guy who has lost quite a bit in terms of body armor and acquired a lot of scar tissue on the way through in bringing about actions nationally and globally on climate change, starting from 2007, 2008, 2009, and through Copenhagen and on to Paris and the rest. Progress has occurred. We've seen that through the agency of Sino-US cooperation most particularly. President Trump has said that won't continue to happen. You saw President Xi Jinping's response to that at Davos when he said, in effect, China will now assume for the first time global leadership on climate change action and action supporting global free trade. Whether China does that or not remains to be seen. But on the substantive action necessary to bring down greenhouse gas emissions, that remains a critical risk, because the climate of itself cannot lie if temperatures are increasing and if water levels begin to rise. That's a reflection of the fact that concrete actions have not been taken. And that is a deep endemic risk facing us all. 10 risks for the year of living dangerously. The first 9 more immediate, the last one of the 10, for the period ahead, because we don't know when the final cracking point for the planet might actually be. Thank you for your time.
Well, Kevin, I can't say that I actually feel relieved by your insights, but thank you anyway. Kevin, earlier today in another conversation, you were talking about the significance of the example that we set in the way we conduct ourselves within the framework of our own democracy here in the U.S. I really appreciate it if you could expand on that a little bit. Sure. I think that was an interesting point and an important one.
Well, this is a strong, robust democracy. And therefore, when your founding fathers, and they were all fathers, described this American experience as a light on the hill, over the decades and over the centuries, that filtered to the rest of the world. And it inspired generations of political reformers in Europe in particular, but more broadly in other parts of the world as well. Gandhi, etc., in India. So for Americans who are legitimately preoccupied internally with the great debates within your democracy, my only comment as a foreigner who is a friend of this country is be very mindful of how this is seen through the lens of global public opinion at a time when the global democratic project itself is under deep stress and threat. A couple of points in addition to that. Leaving aside this most recent US election campaign, if we were simply to look at what globalization, this juggernaut, has produced by way of challenges to the democratic idea in the last 20 years, it's pretty clear for us all to see that globalization, huge advances to prosperity, technology, capital, rapid movement of the same, but on questions of social contract and ensuring that everybody remains part of the project and has an opportunity through equality of opportunity to become part of the prosperity story, we all know that over that 20-25 year period, there's been a whole lot of people left behind and have fallen off completely. And it's no surprise to this audience of intelligent and engaged citizens that what has happened here in the United States is part of that. But you also see it across Europe, and you see it across other countries as well, where the globalists and the globalizers are the people who are perceived to now have succeeded, and those who have not become, in fact, the most radical opponents of the continuation of the globalization project. And democracies, as a result, become fractured because those who have succeeded form one group and those who have not succeeded and or failed form another. In fact, they see little point in the continuation of the democratic project. So that is one set of things happening. And then on another, in China, for example, is an unapologetic advocate of its own state capitalist model. Nothing to do with liberal democracy, that's for the West. But now they say dysfunctional as well. Look at elections in Europe, look at Brexit, mad decision according to the Chinese, but a product of a democratic model. Look at the rise of far right-wing parties, mad from the Chinese perspective. Look at the phenomenon which has unfolded in the United States, for which they've been equally critical. Go to the People's Daily, page 4 today, you'll see a whole boom page about this is what American democracy produces for you. And so for those who have been in the Chinese political system looking for the light on the hill, quite patiently, over a long period of time, there is now this fragility about whether the light remains real or not. Now, I, for one, as a passionate Democrat, know that democracy is self-correct. They're the great political stabilizers within our system. And in divided governments such as yours and the one that I have led, where you've got robust judiciaries and you have robust legislatures, checks and balances work. But I'd say, just as a cautionary message to my American friends, democracy is a fragile thing. In the history of humankind, it's really a 2 centuries long experience. And only in the last century with a universal franchise. I mean, for God's sake, less than 100 years ago, women didn't even have the vote in many of the so-called progressive Western democracies of today. And so we have to tend its garden very carefully. Otherwise, the flame extinguishes.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're hearing from the Honorable Kevin Rudd. He's the former Prime Minister and former Foreign Minister of Australia. He's now President of the Asia Society's Policy Institute. He's in conversation with Ken Wilcox, co-chairman of the Advisory Board of the Asia Society Northern California. This event was recorded before an audience in San Francisco. And now back to the conversation.
Kevin, here's a short question that takes advantage of your unique role as an Australian. What is your take on Trump's abusive attitude toward the Australian Prime Minister?
Well, that's a really good one. The current Australian Prime Minister and myself have not exactly had the most robust of relationships. I think, how do I answer this diplomatically? all I'd say is this. When I was in office, picture this, I'm elected, President Bush desperately wanted the guy I was up against, the then Prime Minister of Australia, to win the election. Why? Because then Prime Minister Howard was a 100% supporter of the Iraq invasion in 2003. In fact, one of only 3 combatant states, the United States, the United Kingdom, and Australia. That was it. And we, the Labour Party opposition stage at that time, fundamentally opposed it from day one. It's quite rare for us because we have had a bipartisan history of supporting the United States alliance since the get-go. In fact, all major wars since 1917, Australia and the United States have been in the trenches together. First World War, Second World War, Korea, Vietnam, First Iraq War, Second Iraq War, Afghanistan, the whole lot. So we don't take these decisions lightly when we just say, nah, we think this is dumb. But that's the decision we took in 2003, and we were excoriated for it as the leader, as Her Majesty's loyal opposition in Australia. So President Bush obviously wanted his buddy John Howard to win subsequent elections, which he did in 2004. But then I came along in 2007 and said, this is unconscionable. By then, Iraq was just a complete diabolical disaster. And without going into an entire Iraq conversation, President Bush was not ecstatic when I won the election. Okay. But what was really interesting was, in the period following that, because our terms then overlapped for at least a year, where I was actually in the business of negotiating withdrawal of all Australian forces from Iraq. Tricky business. We managed to do this in the framework of a very civilized conversation among allies about how you could do this without creating, let's say, operational dilemmas in the field for remaining forces. I would hope that when we have policy differences in the future between this administration and the Australian government on whatever question, it could be handled in a similar manner. I'll leave it there.
So, Kevin, here are a couple of questions that are related, and I'd like to weave them together under yet a third question. And that is that on the one hand, we have a China that is anxious to play a greater role on the world stage. And on the other hand, we have so many isolationist movements in the Western world. How is this going to play out over time? So the first question here is, do you think isolationist events around the world are a short-term trend or indicative of a larger global shift? And the other related question is, are we witnessing even greater than the, I have to reword this a little bit, are we witnessing, I guess, a withdrawal of the U.S. from global interventionist, from its global interventionist role? Are we witnessing the end of 500 years of European, then Euro-American domination?
Okay, why don't we throw into that the history the history of the Western novel as well. Okay, let's start with the Hesiod, and we'll move on to the ancient Greek classics and a bit of Herodotus. Okay, a few thoughts in response to that. First, isolationism. Second, American global leadership. Thirdly, could China fill the space? That's kind of my distillation from the question. On the first one, isolationism, the answer to that question is conditional on one thing. Can Western liberal democracies and economies reinvent their social contracts to keep the broad population within the family or not? If they do, then people have a stake in the future of the liberal democratic and liberal capitalist model. If they don't, they will progressively reject it and turn in to various forms of localism, tribalism, and nationalism. That, I think, is the core element of the challenge faced across Europe today. If you're going to allow large groups of people to grow in your country who are falling further and further behind relative to where they see the oases of prosperity lying within their countries, put yourself in their position, and the response will be, I don't like that. I want to change it. The traditional political processes are failing. I therefore am going to give this extreme candidate, either the right or the left, a chance to do something about it. And often the formulas offered by the extreme right and extreme left are in fact isolationist rather than globalist. On the second one, which is American global leadership, I think the answer to that, again, is conditional. How will President Trump's basic policy instincts and convictions be reflected in real public policy? We still don't know. But it's not for an idle reason, I presume, that President Trump now has to his desk and slightly to one side the portrait of President Andrew Jackson, Old Hickory, known for his populism. Old Hickory would not have seen himself as an early American globalist or internationalist. And if you look carefully at what President Trump has said, he basically has seen an international rules-based system which, in his conclusion, has delivered results which do not support the American national interest, but have detracted from it and detracted from American national power. So they're the instincts, but the open question is, and the caveat therefore is, how many of those instincts will be translated into concrete public policy decisions? Finally, can China fill this vacuum? I think the answer to that is tactically yes, strategically no. What do I mean by that? Tactically, the Chinese moved with the speed of lightning for Xi Jinping to be at Davos this year to deliver an extraordinary speech, which simply said, A, well, on the future of globalization and global free trade, there is no alternative. It must continue. Open bracket, sotto voce, and we'll be in this business of providing that leadership, close brackets. And there's a self-interest for China because so much of its historical and recent wealth has come from the traded sector of its economy. Secondly, similarly on climate change. It cannot be avoided, according to Xi Jinping. in terms of national actions consistent with the Paris Agreement, we China are going to continue to act. Now, this was a remarkable statement, elegantly crafted, a most atypical Chinese speech, if those of you looked at the text, because it's not produced by the propaganda department. It's produced by people who know what it is to address a bunch of Davosisters, the people who inhabit Davos. And from people I've spoken to who went to Davos, said that he really took the crowd with him. So his tactical ability to fill this vacuum, I think, is demonstrated very quickly and ably and effectively in a remarkable speech. Why I'm skeptical strategically is that it's not within China's national conceptual software to come up with a system, a conceptual system, for how any alternate global order might function. What you see instead is an emerging set of Chinese, what I describe as critiques on how elements of the current system work, rather than a demand that the current system disappear. Where's the rubber hit the road with all of that? The system has existed since 45, has also assumed the continued global engagement of the United States in all domains. If that changes, and there is no single power providing that underpinning dynamic to keeping the whole system going, and if no states provide that, where do you end up? Great article by Joe Nye, friend and colleague from Harvard University, on what he calls the Kindleberger trap, which is referring to what happened in global governance after the end of the First World War, when Britain was no longer capable of providing global governance because its economy and country had been gutted by the experiences on the Western Front. And the United States, after President Wilson's intervention at Versailles, was undercut by the American Senate, and the United States then withdrew from global governance. We fell into a vortex in the period from 1919 to 1939, and we know what happened then. The question now is, who then fills this gap? And that, I think, is a core question for the future of global governance now. That's why I listed it as one of my 10 risks.
So I think I'm going to reword this next question a little bit in order to allow your last statement to provide a segue. How could we best fudge the situation in North Korea?
Well, despite the fact I like fudge, the chocolate fudge, there's a lot about North Korea we can't fudge because it's... If you were to dismember the conflicting national interests at stake in the South China Sea, there are not many. If you were to go to hydrocarbons, maybe. Fish stocks, very significant in terms of protein consumed within China, but also in Southeast Asia. Not worth going to war over. And so if you pulled away these factors and just looked at them objectively, what's alive in the South China Sea is basically deep nationalist sentiment between various of the Southeast Asian states and China, and amplified by the historical toxicities in particular between Vietnam and China, which have been around for 1,000 years. So that's the South China Sea. Go to North Korea, there's an objective problem. This regime has 15 bombs, nuclear bombs. Second, it's acquiring more nuclear material to make new bombs each year, probably another 5 each year. Two, they've already got pretty sophisticated short-range rocketry with accuracy, medium-range missiles with some accuracy, long-range missiles, growing accuracy, and an open question on a submarine launch capability, which was once scorned as a possibility, but maybe not scorned so much, having looked at recent technical analyses. And the third element of all that is, can you miniaturize the first to put it on the end of the second to have a nuclear weapon which can then objectively threaten South Korea, Japan, Guam, Hawaii, or here? And associated allies, including Australia, for example. if a long-range missile reaches the West Coast, it also reaches Northern Australia. So these are objective factors which you cannot fudge. You either have these capabilities or you don't. And if you are in a position, therefore, of making, therefore, the big strategic choice, are you going to accept a nuclear-armed North Korea as a responsible member of the global nuclear weapons family? Then the world's reaction to that is about as silent as his room has just been, which is, not sure about that. To put this in context, the great intensity of the negotiation which occurred in the last 2 years on the Iranian nuclear deal was about a country, namely Iran, which had no nuclear material, certainly sophisticated rocketry, no miniaturization capability, and all of that was about preventing a breakout. Well, the Koreans are so far broken out a long, long way that they're at the outer fence. So that's the context in which I put this. So what can be done? The real question here is, can two things occur? Can the Chinese now leverage the North Koreans in a way which will have an effect on North Korean behavior by radically reducing or cutting off the supply of energy through the supply of oil, where Korea remains dependent on Chinese supply? That's where the meat of the conversation will now go between the United States and China, I think. What will China's response be? I don't know. And Chinese internal opinion is divided, but China is no friend of the North Korean regime. The second question is, let's just assume hypothetically that could occur. What then is the other side of the equation? What's then in it for the North, apart from just losing your energy supplies? And that's where the political imagination has to exist between the country's two leaders, namely the United States and China, for a grand bargain on the Korean Peninsula. A grand bargain which conceives of the possibility of a confederation between the two countries, still allowing the two political systems to continue, for there to be a formal peace treaty between the United States and North Korea, which in the period since 1953 has not existed. We've simply got an armistice, a ceasefire. We don't have a peace treaty. And thirdly, what then becomes the nature of the economic aid package to support the development needs of North Korea? And fourthly, what does all of the above mean for the future presence of US troops in South Korea, or are they withdrawn as part of this aggregate grand bargain? That's the architecture of what could occur, but frankly, each of those has a degree of difficulty which almost goes through the roof. We have a crying need now for statesmen and women to step up on this question. So I fear, as the clock goes past midnight with the North Koreans, we are then into new and uncertain territory, which we haven't been in since 53.
So another question relates to a discussion that Kevin led earlier today at the Hoover Institution at Stanford. And in the course of that discussion, there were several people who commented as follows. A lot of public opinion and government opinion in the U.S. is informed to one degree or another by a body of folks that we'll refer to as the old China hands. There may be a couple of hundred of them, or maybe 400 or 500, it's hard to count, but these are the China experts, often people that have been focused on China for the past 30 to 40 years. Many of them went to undergraduate school at places like University of Michigan and other China programs, China studies programs, 30, 40 years ago. They've been, I think, influencing our thoughts around China all that time, and they've been very, very hopeful that China was evolving in a direction that conformed to their vision of an ideal China at some point in the future. Many of them feel somewhat betrayed, is a word that we sometimes hear, as if the direction they thought China was moving, it turns out just in this last couple of years, it appears maybe China's not moving in that direction. And some people that spend time in Washington feel that there is a little bit of a sea change going on in terms of our interpretation of China. I was wondering if you could comment on that.
Given I'm still in my 50s, am I an old China hand, or am I...
You're sort of a middle fellow.
Okay. That's cheered me up a little bit for the evening. Let's try and respond to that question by looking at it in terms of, objectively, what's occurring in China on those questions. Secondly, American perceptions and expectations, and where to from here. Objectively, what can we say about China in terms of, let's call it, the trajectory towards economic and political liberalism, which was the assumption of many in their first engagement with the Chinese once Deng Xiaoping proclaimed Dui Wai Kai Fang, Dui Ni Gai Ge, opening to the outside world in the third plenum of the 11th Central Committee in October of 1978. And throughout the 80s, that was still the tenor of the Western expectation of what would unfold within China. Then, notwithstanding what happened in Tiananmen in June of 89, there was a further and continuing expectation of that in one form or another during the 90s. In China itself, my own observations through conversations with colleagues and friends who I've known since Adam was a boy, was that the party itself in the early 2000s, probably in the period 2001 to 2003, conducted quite a deep internal discussion and dialogue about the future evolution of the Communist Party. Having observed what happened in Western, in Eastern Europe in 1991 or between 89 and 91, was it necessary to be in control of your own political evolution over time, for the Communist Party to evolve into more of a social democratic party, more of a democratically elected social democratic party, more following one form or another of what was then constituted as the Singaporean model. Singapore, of course, being something of a city-state compared with 1.2 billion people as it was then. Now 1.4. That debate concluded in the direction is that that was not going to be acceptable to the leadership. And that was a debate which, as I said, concluded around 2003. In my own assessment. Then you come forward, roll the clock forward to President Xi Jinping and his election about a decade after that. And Xi Jinping's answer to those questions about the future of the economic order and the future political order, I think, has been a definitive statement about what was then an internal conclusion about the likely future shape of the Chinese political and economic system. Xi Jinping's definitive statement was this: the party will be with us for 100 years. It was formed in 1921. Its anniversary is 2021. It brought unity to China in 49. It's going to be around in 2049. Anything that'll stop us being around is if we're a corrupt political party, hence the anti-corruption campaign. He made the statement one day after having been sworn in, by the way. If anyone was sort of having any doubt in reading the tea leaves. And then, as we've observed it, the Chinese economic model is not a classic liberal capitalist model, it's a state capitalist model, with a continued strong role for SOEs, albeit smaller than it was before. So the assumption, therefore, which is held by many in the West, but some within China as well, that bit by bit, with fits and starts and ups and downs, China was drifting in this particular direction of an open society, an open economy, and an open political system, is, I think, objectively wrong. The one caveat is this. And if you've been to China as much as I have over the years, you've seen this enormous liberation in Chinese individual lifestyles. Mm. If you had have said to me 10 years ago that you can openly talk about gay rights in Beijing and in China, 10 years ago I would have said, you've been smoking something, which is legal in the state of Colorado at least, maybe here as well. But it doesn't actually make a lot of sense. Now, there is individual rights, gay rights on lifestyle questions in China, which is remarkably free and remarkably liberal. But with the point at which you cross the threshold into political rights, doesn't, literally, the Chinese expression is it doesn't walk. And that's where we've got to with the China today. So to conclude my answer to your question, in terms of American expectations and international expectations, yes, I think they have been deeply disappointed. Were they realistic in the first place? Probably not. But I think the evidence is now in that this expectation of what China would become has not been realized. Therefore, and I conclude on this, the natural constituency in this country, which has existed not just from old China hands, but the business constituency and the political constituencies and the others, the NGO constituencies as well, saying, let's go with China for the long term because it's on this long march towards political and economic liberalization. Those constituencies are now collapsing. And we have a very raw level of support, in fact, a raw level of opposition towards China now in the United States, and I see this alive in Europe as well. That is why, in some respects, the Trump phenomenon is of a particularly challenging nature, because Mr. Trump is not in himself uniquely and individually reflecting an anti-Chinese posture which is peculiar just to him. I think he has picked up across the broad society a deep sea change in American opinions as well. So that's another reason why I think we're in for troubling times.
So, Kevin, one final California-centric question. Okay. And that is, anybody who's been following foreign direct investment out of China into California over the years will have noticed that the curve, I think from your point of view now, in the audience, looks more or less like this. After years and years and years of very little foreign direct investment from China into California, in these past two or three years, it has shot up just like this. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering how we should feel about that. I personally, in the past 3 months, have had numerous conversations with representatives of SOEs from China, private equity firms with government money from China, venture capital firms with money that may or may not be government money from China. And if I add up all the numbers that have been given to me, now, I don't know how seriously you can take any single number, but we're talking about $15 to $20 billion looking to buy technology in one form or another in California. Remember that the venture capital industry in the entire United States only consumes about $60 billion a year these days. So 15 to 20 in California alone, at the very least, has the potential, if it materializes, to create a bubble. How should we feel about this level of investment? Is it a good thing? Is it a questionable thing? Should we be happy or should we worry? What do you think?
Well, I'm not California's psychologist, so I find it difficult to answer that question. Let me just tell you a little about the Australian experience. As when I was in office and through until about 2013, we were China's single largest destination of FDI, Australia. Okay, and that's only 3 years or so ago. Mm. And so, as you said, that hockey stick has exploded, not just here, but also in Europe. I think Australia as a destination is probably now about number three. And it's spread over a number of sectors, as it is, I think, here. You've got property, and you've got a bunch of other, in the case of Australia, resource industries, but certainly you see it globally in terms of the purchase of, let's call it, technology concentrated firms, both here, Germany, Australia. So here's a simple question and a simple rule of thumb, which I always say to my Chinese friends when I've been in office and I get grumpy about a particular foreign investment decision which we may have knocked over, which means not approved, is, okay, comrade, what if I was to make this investment in a Chinese firm and take it over, would you permit it? Usually a long silence at the other end of the conversation. I said, okay, I want to invest in, you know, this huge deposit of rare earths in Qinghai because we're good at rare earths in our country. You'll permit it? No. I said, so I want to, basically, you've got two or three emerging, interesting high-tech companies which are publicly or privately owned by mixed ownership arrangements. Will you allow us to do it? No. Okay. So the rule of thumb, I believe, in this globalized economy is simply one of equivalent treatment. And this is very important in dealing with our Chinese friends, to cause Chinese policymakers and regulators to understand that this generally is not a one-way street. It must be a two-way street. Otherwise, you're going to have an excessive reaction from regulators in the United States and elsewhere in the world just closing the door. And I think that's a wise and fair way to look at the future. Because, and the final point is this, on the upside is, if those rules become genuinely equitable and enforced as such, the opportunities for available levels of financial capital out of China, out of the United States, with common technology projects, particularly on clean and renewable energies, given the demands in both countries, and more broadly in sustainable industries, is huge. China desperately needs these things domestically. But a mercantilist approach which says you can obtain that capacity by simply vacuuming up a whole bunch of IP from around the world is just not sustainable, because the political constituency necessary to support those sort of arrangements will collapse and you'll have a total reaction against it. So equitable investment treatment, equitable enforcement within jurisdictions, and most critically, policeable under third-party jurisdictions, namely international commercial arbitration mechanisms in third capitals. If you do that, then we can make it work as a genuine two-way street.
Well, Kevin, thank you very much. That was a wonderful and very illuminating discussion. We appreciate your being here. On behalf of the Asia Society Northern California, on behalf of World Affairs, on behalf of China SF, on behalf of the Japan Society of Northern California, we thank you for your contribution.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a membership organization, and we're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured a conversation with the Honorable Kevin Rudd. He's the former Prime Minister and former Foreign Minister of Australia, and he's now President of the Asia Society Policy Institute. He was in conversation with Ken Wilcox, who co-chairs the Asia Society Northern California Advisory Board. This broadcast is made possible weekly by the generous support of Chevron. Our recording engineer is Rob Spate. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.